Well, tonight's one of those nights we've been waiting for, the great debate between Michael Rupert from thewilderness.com, Jerome Corsi, Black Gold Stranglehold. We're going to talk about oil. We're going to talk about the myth. Is it produced deep within this planet naturally, or does it come from other ways? Is it fossils and plants? And then we'll talk about peak oil as well. These two have worked at this for a long time. They're ready to go. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back with Michael Rupert, Jerome Corsi, The Great Debate on Oil on Coast to Coast AM. Is oil a renewable source produced deep inside the planet, or a finite resource which will become more scarce within our lifetime? That's what our debate is about tonight. Michael Rupert is the publisher-editor of From the Wilderness, or FTW, a newsletter he founded in 1998. Through the newsletter and his website, which is fromthewilderness.com, Mike has pioneered innovative analysis and groundbreaking stories on the multi-billion-dollar U.S. drug economy and the illegal covert operations which maintain control of that cash flow for U.S. economic interests. Since 9/11, he has been the point man in breaking major stories involving government foreknowledge, some corruption and violations of the Constitution. He has also pioneered the effort to educate all of us about the consequences of what he calls peak oil. An honors graduate of UCLA in political science, Mike is a former Los Angeles police officer, narcotics investigator, who discovered CIA trafficking in drugs in 1977. He's back on Coast to Coast tonight. Hi, Michael. How are you?
I'm great. It's good to be with you.
Good. Good to be with you, too. All well over the years since we talked last time, June, almost a year and a half ago.
Yeah, the 2005 was an extremely busy year with a lot of challenges for us, but it's going well. We're just about ready to relocate to Southern Oregon, and I'm very much looking forward to that.
Very good. Over and above this program tonight with Jerry Corsi, Michael, we've got to get you back on again, okay?
Thank you. There's some
other issues, too. Jerome Corsi received his Ph.D., from Harvard University in political science. He has written many books and articles. He's an expert on political violence and terrorism. In 1981, he received a top secret clearance from the Agency for International Development, where he assisted in providing anti-terrorism hostage survival training to embassy personnel. In 2005, Dr. Corsi helped found and launch the Iran Freedom Foundation, which is a not-for-profit educational and charitable organization established to educate all of us about the Islamic Republic of Iran and to promote freedom in the region. He's got a couple books under his belt, at least Black Gold Stranglehold and Atomic Iran. We talked to Jerry just not too long ago about the Iranian situation. That, unfortunately, Jerry, I think we're going to have to get you back again for a full program because I think things are literally heating up on that end.
Oh, you're right, George. It's a great honor to be back with you, and I'm looking forward to the debate with Michael.
What we shall do, first of all, is I'm going to play this one, folks, right down the middle. You will have no idea what position I'm taking today as I question both of you, and as both of you talk between each other about this issue, because you both bring fascinating arguments to the table for this. I've got a coin here. I've got a quarter in my hand. I'm going to flip it. Jerry, you say heads or tails. This is for whether you want to go first or second in opening statements. A reasonable opening statement. I'm not going to give you a watch unless I think you've gone way too long. But we'll start with you. You call it heads or tails, and I'll flip it. Then the winner decide if they want to go first or second in this, because the person who goes first will go last at the end of this debate.
Great. I'll call heads.
All right. Here it goes. I'm gonna do this scientifically, Jerry and Michael. I'm gonna let the quarter hit the top of my desk here. Here we go. It is. Want to verify this, Daniel, our engineer?
Tails.
Tails. It is. So, Mr. Rupert, your choice.
Okay. Well, thank you. I hadn't prepared an opening statement, although we had done some points, but. This debate can be framed fairly simply. One school here says that oil is a finite resource on a finite planet, a closed sphere, derived from decaying animal and plant life from the oceans, which dropped and was covered over by sediments, which was progressively covered over by more layers of sediments to produce, under the right circumstances, hydrocarbons, as we know them. No one debates, no one disputes that abiotic methane exists throughout the universe. It's a different isotope, C13, carbon 13, as opposed to carbon 12, which is universally recognized here on Earth as being a product of life. All of the methane gas here is the C12, or most of it, 99.9% of it. On the other hand, if you were to say what the other school of thought says, which is that oil is an infinite resource, somehow being oil and gas, somehow being magically produced by the planet itself, and is virtually, for the sake of our discussion, limitless, then you have to deal with two problems. You have to discuss, number one, the rate at which this oil is produced. The strong abiotic theory holds that oil is produced as fast as we can use it, which doesn't make sense historically or from any scientific standpoint, because man only started tapping the oil about 110 years ago, and had oil been replenishing that fast over the 4 billion years of Earth's history, we would be drowning in oil right now. The surface of the planet would be covered in oil. Most abiotic theorists argue for the slow abiotic theory, which is basically that on a geologic time scale, the Earth is creating oil at about the same rate that the organic or the peak oil people argue, in which case it's irrelevant. There is no evidence. There are no successfully producing abiotic wells. All of the research documenting or alleging refilling reservoirs, whether on Eugene Island or anywhere else, are dated, and these fields are all now in decline. The one and only abiotic well that was ever drilled in Sweden was an abysmal failure. It produced no oil whatsoever. So there is no evidence anywhere that abiotic oil or gas is being commercially introduced or used by anyone on the planet anywhere now. The whole argument that this stuff is there is just basically flawed. A freshman college chemistry student could debunk it in about 5 minutes. I'll stop with that.
Okay, that is Michael Rupert and Jerry Corsi. Of course, you were not aware either of an opening statement, but it's now your turn.
George, just a couple simple points. One, the abiotic theory argues that oil is created naturally in the earth on a constant basis, that it seeps up through cracks in the bedrock and forms in sedimentary rock and pools, where it accumulates biological debris and is typically confused as being biological in nature. The abiotic theory goes back really to Mendeleev in the 1800s, a Russian scientist who refuted an earlier Russian scientist who said in the 1700s that oil came from dinosaurs and ancient forests. Now, the biological theory has been a shifting theory. Currently, but people maintaining oil as a biological product don't want to talk about dinosaurs. But at any rate, I'm going to maintain today that oil is an abiotic product, and that oil and methane are produced throughout our solar system. We find methane that's abiotic. We find it here on Earth. And that peak oil, as a consequence, is not true. It's a hoax. That we're not running out of oil. We have more proven reserves of oil and natural gas today than ever in human history, despite doubling the use of oil and natural gas since the 1970s. So I think that's the basis we're going to debate tonight, and I look forward to it.
Okay, what we'll do then for this hour, I'll just chat with both of you, asking you questions, and then next hour I'm going to allow you to be a little more free-flowing between each other, and you can discuss, you can go at it reasonably, gentlemen. And then in the last hour, the third hour, we'll just open up the phone lines and allow you to take phone calls from our coast-to-coast audience, the vast audience, because this is a very important topic. It's an important topic because wars are fought over oil. Economies are set over oil. Your job in some form or fashion may be directly related to oil. And if the economy of the United States should ever falter, it's going to be because the automobile industry goes belly up, or the price of oil goes too high, or something like that affects it. And that's why it's so important to hear from these two who have spent years doing some work and research. By the end of this debate, You make up your own mind, because that's what this is all about. But we're going to give you some resources. We're going to point out their websites. You can go ahead and really begin to do your own investigating into this as well. Michael, the fuel theory, where a lot of people, including Jerry, will say that oil does not come from fossil fuel. His definition of fossil fuel would be plant life and dinosaurs. He's used this phrase before. Where do you believe the fuel, the oil, truly comes from?
Well, it's not where I believe, because I'm not a scientist. I'm a journalist, and I'm a researcher, so I read, I study. In every high school geology class, high school level, and every college level chemistry and geology class, what is taught is not that, you know, I'm not responsible for the term fossil fuel. Why do you drive in a parkway and park in a driveway? Fossils don't contain energy. I didn't make up that term. So the oil and natural gas come from organic matter, carbon-based life forms, which are put in, if you will, following a recipe that happens to exist uniquely on, as far as we know, on this planet, as far as gas is, as oil is concerned, but also uniquely only at certain levels underneath the Earth's surface. The Earth's crust is about 30 miles on average deep. It's a little bit thinner under the ocean and thicker elsewhere on land. The deepest that anybody can drill is 6 miles, but when you get down to what's called an oil window, which is roughly between, oh, I would say 7,000 and 15,000 feet, that's when you have the right right conditions of temperature and pressure to transform the carbon from these decaying life forms into various forms of hydrocarbon matter, whether it be tar, oil, oil sands, etc., or natural gas. Natural gas is the simplest of all hydrocarbons. It is one carbon atom surrounded by four hydrogen atoms. When you put oil under any kind of excess temperature at surface over 100 degrees, it cracks or it breaks down into methane. When you go deeper, the abiotic oil people argue is that pressure allows the temperatures to raise, allowing the oil to be safe, but that's true only to about 275 degrees Fahrenheit, after which that oil always breaks down to natural gas. You can duplicate that experiment in any laboratory anywhere in the world. So it's very clear that there has been, for the 110 years of oil exploration, an absolute perfect correlation between the discovery of oil and natural gas and sedimentary rock. One of the areas touted by the abiotic advocates, the Dnepr Donets Basin, is surrounded by sedimentary rock, and oil migrates just as it would if you squeezed a sponge. But there's always trace markers of biogenic origin, and there's always source rock somewhere close to any oil.
Michael, what I can't understand is thousands and thousands of feet down, somewhere, let's say, even beneath the ocean floor, we have oil. How did the decaying life, whatever it might have been, how did it get down there so far in order to begin to form, because of all the Earth abilities to turn this then into oil?
Well, according to what's taught in chemistry and geology courses, these organisms once filled, I mean literally filled, the planet's oceans. The chemistry of the water was right, the Earth's temperature was right, et cetera, the sunlight was right. And so these formed in abundance, and there were die-offs. We know of many die-offs and many changes, many extinctions in the Earth's history, when massive climate changes occurred, et cetera. When these organisms died, they floated to the bottom, and there they settled. Over time, with tectonic plate movement, with volcanic eruptions, with, you know, just the Earth being the Earth, these organisms were covered by other layers of sand and, or, you know, limestone or whatever the case may be, and they were literally compressed, compacted, and cooked.
Jerry Corsi, you don't believe that oil is made purely from fossil fuels.
Well, right. I don't don't think biological material has anything to do with the creation of oil. Biological material is fairly commonly distributed evenly in sedimentary rock wherever it's deposited, but oil is not found evenly. Oil is found in pockets and pools. It's also found at very, very deep levels, George. The abiotic theory was first developed really by the Russians at the end of World War II, who were finding oil down as deep as 8 to 10 miles under the surface of the earth. And we today continue to find oil that far down, and natural gas, down well below 3 miles. We also find oil and natural gas in volcanic rock, in rock that has no sedimentary content to it whatsoever, all of which supports the thesis that hydrogen and carbon combine within the mantle of the earth. They come up through cracks into the bedrock and settle in the sedimentary rock, and the oil along the way picks up biological content coming up in those pools above the cracks in the sedimentary rock, and is confused to have been of biological content because it has biological debris in it. Also, there's a lot of biological organisms that have never seen the light of day that can live off of oil and do live off of oil and combine with it. So it's not uncommon for oil to have a lot of biological debris in it. It does not mean, though, it was created by a biological cause. That's the distinction.
Now, Jerry, this world, this planet, is acting as if we're running out of fuel. You know, the theory is, and Michael calls it, and so many others, peak oil theory.
Right.
They're acting as if we're running out because we're fighting various regions around this planet for oil. People are obsessed with finding oil. If the abiotic theory were true, and we would have an abundance of it, what are we fighting for?
Well, George, the idea that we're going to run out of oil, first documented evidence of that I've been able to find is actually in the 1800s. The U.S. Geological Service said we're going to run out of oil in California. We're not going to have any more in California. And in fact, if you look at energy studies worldwide, including coal, there's always concerns that are Malthusian in nature that we're going to run out of the quantity of oil or energy available. Malthus was famous for saying that the population was going to exceed the ability to produce food and everybody was going to die of starvation, or there were going to be massive deaths because of starvation. And it just never happened. Technology improved. The ability to create food was much greater than Malthus thought. And it's the same right now with energy. The U.S. Department of Energy, the Energy Information Administration, says there's 1.28 trillion barrels of oil worldwide in proven reserves. Now, that's more than ever in human history, despite the fact that consumption of oil worldwide has doubled since the 1970s. I'm 59 years old. I've been hearing since I was a child, riding around in Cleveland with my father in a 1952 Plymouth, and him telling me we were going to run out of oil. I've been hearing it all my life. And the truth is we have more oil and natural gas available today than ever, and the statistics of the reserves just do not support.
But why fight for it then? Why?
Well, I think, George, people get it in their minds. This whole peak oil theory is the predominant theory. It'll come as a surprise to many listeners that we would even question that oil is not fossil fuel.
So you're saying that some of the wars that are fought for oil, economics, that the people who go to war believe we're running out of oil.
Right, and also, George, it's excellent marketing. There's good reasons for the oil oligopolies to continue to convince people that oil is scarce. You certainly can charge a higher price for something that's scarce.
All right, hold that thought, Jerry, and then we're going to get the rest of your statement. We'll go back to Michael with the same question of why we seem to be fighting to the death for oil. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment with this great debate with Jerome Corsi and Michael Rupert on Coast to Coast AM. And our special guest tonight, Michael Rupert, Jerome Corsi, Jerry Corsi, we call him. We'll be back in a moment with a great debate on oil on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Jerry, we'll let you finish up to that question, then we'll turn it over to Michael to get his response on why we go to war for oil if you believe that it's abiotic and it's in abundance.
Well, I think the point I was making is that the oil companies have it in their interest to make people believe, to continue the idea that oil is fossil fuel. If oil is fossil fuel, there are only ever so many fossils, so there can only ever be so much oil. It's got a peak. That's the nature of the concept, and we'll have a world where we run out of oil. But the argument we made in Black Gold Stranglehold is that numbers have not validated that. There's been a fear and a hoax that we would run out of energy, including coal. It's never happened. There's more oil proven reserves and natural gas today. In world history, we've never had this much, despite the doubling of use worldwide of oil and natural gas since the 1970s. So the statistics don't bear that we're running out of oil or natural gas.
Michael, it's obvious, I guess, to you that we go to war for oil because you believe we're running out of it.
Well, of course I do, and of course it's obvious if we look at the fact that oil prices have trebled 300% since 2001, natural gas prices in the U.S. up 115% in the last year. Prices are going up worldwide. There are shortages. And I absolutely, vigorously, and totally disagree with Mr. Corsi's statement that reserves are higher than they've ever been. Shell Oil had to downgrade its reserves because it was cooking its books. The reserve numbers that are out there are not scientific numbers. They're accounting numbers. Oil companies pay taxes based upon their stated reserves in the ground. So what oil companies will do if they find a field with, let's say, 600 million barrels, they will declare a find of 200 million 1 year, 100 million the next. They'll spread it out so they can amortize their tax bill.
They don't want to pay the whole thing lump sum, right?
Their share prices are based upon what they state in the ground. There are like five different categories of reserves. There's probable reserves, estimated reserves, proven reserves, ultimately recoverable reserves, all of which are different SEC terms that have to do with accounting.
Heck, doesn't it make more sense to come in low if you're going to have to pay taxes on it?
Well, no, but you also have to. It's a double-edged sword, which Dick Cheney has addressed, and I have a quote from him in my book, Crossing the Rubicon, where he acknowledges that oil is a finite resource and living and running out, and I'm not a great fan of Dick Cheney, but the fact is that global oil discoveries peaked in the early 1960s. We're now using, within the last 2 years, 6 barrels of oil for every new barrel that is discovered. We are absolutely consuming more. The gap is growing wider. Now, Mr. Corsi used a figure of 1.28 trillion barrels. Most scientists agree on both sides of the issue that the original endowment, or at least on my side, was on the planet was about 2 trillion barrels. Give or take, now we're estimating about a trillion barrels left, which means we've used half, which, if you follow the bell curve, is at the peak of the bell curve. But the fact is that IHS Energy Consultants in Denver, which is you can get their report on oil fields, it costs about $45,000, the CIA buys it, has documented that for the last 2 years, that would be 2003 and 2004, they haven't got the numbers for five yet, not a single field has been discovered on this planet of 500 million barrels. That's a five-day supply for planet Earth. If you look at natural gas, it's the same picture. The Texas Railroad Commission is the Bible, if you will, of the natural gas industry in the United States. What they're documenting now is about 1,800 new wells are being drilled every year, and about 70% of those wells are going dry within 1 year. That's as opposed to the way it was when they first started drilling for gas, when wells were running for 5, 10, 15 years, meaning we have picked all of the low-hanging fruit. We found all of the choice big fields that are to be found. There aren't any more being found, and there's no evidence that any fields are refilling. And I have no idea where Mr. Corsi gets his the statement that proven reserves now are higher than they've ever been. I'd love to hear some documentation.
I'll let you address that, Jerry.
Oh, well, the documentation's right in the Energy Information Administration's statistics, George, and we have it in the book. It's fully footnoted and referenced with an Internet reference in Black Gold Stranglehold. A couple of points. One, you know, Mr. Rupert says that the price of oil is increasing, doubling over some period of time. Well, prices of homes have doubled. Where I live here in New Jersey, It doesn't mean we're running out of homes. We're building new homes all the time. In terms of fields being found, I'm just going to point to a few. The Barnett Shale, which covers 15 counties in Texas, was unappreciated until the 1970s, really only begun to be developed in the 1980s. It has something like 128 trillion cubic feet of natural gas in it, which was not understood until the 1980s. We learned how to fraction it, to break it up, so we could release the natural gas that was in that rock. The Gulf of Mexico, the Cantarell field, which is Mexico's largest field, that was created when the great comet, supposedly at the end of the Mesozoic era, fractured the Yucatan, and it looks like the fractured bed of the Gulf is extreme throughout the entire Gulf. We're only about 10 to 12 miles out in drilling. We're just really getting into the Gulf, but yet we're finding wells like Thunder Horse, which is down about 6 to 8 miles below the surface of the Gulf, and we're getting out of that field 250,000 barrels a day going to 1 million barrels, and it looks like the various fields in the Gulf, all through the Gulf, are connected to a giant pool that's very complicated in terms of the pattern of the flows under the Gulf, but it's a huge reserve, not just one particular field. And the Gulf was unappreciated in terms of having oil going back into the 1980s. So there are many, many oil fields and deposits that are recently developed at very deep levels that were not in the oil reserves even 20 years ago.
Do either one of you know if oil has been produced in a laboratory? Has some scientist been able to make it?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Both oil and natural gas can be produced in a laboratory, but here's the question that everybody has got to get. The question is, how much energy do you spend to make the oil versus how much energy do you get out of the oil? And until you address net energy, you don't get a picture. I mean, you have to cook things and put them under pressure. Well, how do you get the heat? You have to burn other energy to do that. It's not productive. It is not energy efficient. We used to get an energy bang when oil was first discovered of 100 to 1. For every one unit of energy you put in, you would get 100 units of energy from the oil that you produced or natural gas that you produced because it was close to the surface.
I did an interview with a fella in St. Louis years ago who was driving around in a hempmobile. He was able to get fuel out of hemp, and he was pretty proud about that. And I asked him, I said, well, this is very novel, and this could help, you know, downplay in any kind of energy crisis. How much does it cost a gallon? And he said, well, if we had to make it and sell it commercially, it would be about $13 a gallon. Nobody's going to pay that.
Well, they might if gasoline goes to $15 a gallon.
Well, if it goes to $15, I agree. Does that mean we should be actively and aggressively pursuing alternative energy sources?
Not only should we are. We, meaning the human race, business is pouring hundreds of millions of dollars into research into alternative energies. Why would, if there was abundant conventional oil being produced abiotically and relatively easy to get, why would everybody under the sun be going to Canada's tar sands? And it's a major error in Mr. Corsi's book. He has them 1,500 miles out of their proper location. They're in Alberta, not the Mackenzie Delta. But Total is going to the Canadian tar sands. China's going there. And that's enormously more expensive and more damaging to the environment to get that than it is to get regular oil. I was just at a conference in Denver with former Governor Dick Lamb, several members of Congress, and many, many business major business guys who are looking at biodiesel, who are looking at all kinds of alternative fuels. They wouldn't be doing this if oil was abundant.
Jerry?
Well, first of all, George, the oil we are getting and have been getting for 100 and some years, I'm maintaining, is abiotic oil. Mr. Rupert wants to make a distinction that there's some oil that's abiotic and some oil that's biological in nature.
No. That's
okay,
not
well,
just
so we get that clear, I wanted to make it clear that the oil that we have always been getting is abiotic, in my opinion.
In your opinion, okay.
Secondly, in terms of getting deeper oil economically, our technology today, which it did not permit 10 years ago, for us to go down 6-8 miles into the earth. We're able to do that more efficiently. We're doing it in the Gulf. We're doing it offshore. We're doing it deep within the earth. Take a look at the U.S. Department of Energy's Deep Trek site. They have a whole project for going 3 miles and deeper to get methane, which is abundant even in the continental United States and untapped. In terms of the efficiency of going after oil and natural gas, as prices go up, a lot more is able to be gotten efficiently. The tar sands, which, by the way, do extend all the way through the Rocky Mountains up into vast areas of Canada, not just Alberta, but vast areas of Canada, are economically recoverable today, and they weren't 10 or 15 years ago. In terms of producing oil and natural gas in a laboratory, again, your listeners have got to understand that methane has been produced in a laboratory. Methane, abiotic, no plants or animals, is abundant throughout our solar system. It's abundant on Titan, the great moon of Saturn.
Mm-hmm.
It's abundant in throughout the universe. If it can be formed in other planets and in other parts of our solar system, it can be formed here. We're getting abiotic methane that comes out of the earth in the mid-Atlantic crack, deep within the Atlantic Ocean. And that is isotope carbon-13 that's coming out deep within the ocean and the Atlantic Ocean.
Well, do you, Jerry, advocate, if abiotic is true, that we don't explore alternative energy, we just keep pulling out and looking for more oil?
No, I think pursuing alternative energies is a good idea. And I think there's a lot of alternative energies, including a lot of the abiotic processes that become more efficient. I mean, you can take garbage and make methane out of it. The Nazis knew how to take coal and an abiotic process, make diesel fuel out of it. A whole Fischer-Tropsch process, which has been very well documented going back to World War II, completely abiotic, producing diesel fuel. Now, a lot of those processes are becoming economical, and they're being done all over the United States. I mean, George, you can put a pipe into a landfill and get methane, and it doesn't have any biological project that has been dead for, you know, for a million years. That garbage dump has been there recently. And methane is commonly produced in the earth. It's abundant and untapped in many different sources. And, you know, when I was a kid, going back to the 50s, methane was burned off of oil fields. Methane is today an alternative energy that's been developed in recent years and applied in great quantities.
Is it possible that oil might be both? Maybe it is developed from fossils, decayed plants, animals, and that the planet also has a way of making the stuff. Maybe they're not quite exactly the same, but they still do what they need to do for us. Is that possible, Michael Rupert?
Well, nobody, and I am not one of them, I am one of them, I do not dispute the fact that the natural gas on Titan or throughout the solar system, which is in abundance. My father was a part of the space program. I was raised with a lot
yes,
of that science.
I remember that.
Nobody disputes that. But the conditions that exist on the outer gas giants, which is what they're called, all the planets from Jupiter on out, those conditions don't exist on Earth. I mean, there are an infinite variety of combinations of distance from the sun, temperature, size, gravity, specific gravity, mass, so on and so forth. That's what happened there. Mr. Corsi's own book and his citation of NASA facts and figures on the exploration of the moons of Jupiter, like Titan, confirmed that that's all carbon-13 isotope, which is not what the primary component of 99.99% of all the natural gas on this planet is. Yes, abiotic gas, methane, has been found in some vents, but the quantity that has been found is less than the amount of methane produced annually by cow farts. It's not commercially viable. No one disputes that you can make stuff in the laboratory. Now, Congressman Roscoe Bartlett, a Republican of Maryland, who is a friend, and I've visited with him privately in his offices in Washington, has just founded a peak oil caucus in the U.S. House of Representatives, which has 14 members, and I've met with several of them. And Congressman Bartlett points out, quite rightly, saying that, look, Sure. At present rates of consumption, we may have 250 years worth of coal in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then he does the math, which he does beautifully. He talks about compound exponential growth. In other words, at a 2% growth rate in consumption, that's 2% next year and then 2% on top of that
growth the following year. Right, it multiplies.
We are down to 50 years of coal. Now when we talk about Fischer-Tropsch process, which has been improved since the Germans tried it, you're still back to the net energy question. But if you try to replace current consumption of gasoline or conventional oil with Fischer-Tropsch, then you've got maybe 5 years worth of coal left in this country. Plus, you have to build the infrastructure, which is incredibly costly. These arguments do not make sense. Sure, I can make abiotic methane in a laboratory. It takes me a lot of energy, but it can be done.
Well, when do you think we're going to run out? If peak oil is true, if it's real, this theory, when's the spigot going to run dry?
Well, okay, that's George, that's a common way that most people have to look at the issue of peak oil and gas. I will say categorically, and Mr. Corsi is probably going to be pulled back when I say this, we're never going to run out of oil. The reason why is an oil field is deemed to be dry when it takes more energy to get a barrel of oil out of the ground than you get from burning the barrel of oil.
It's economics, isn't it?
Absolutely true. Why would you spend $1.20 to get a dollar?
You wouldn't.
George, I'm going to say not only are we never going to run out of it, we're never going to run out of it being economical. We have not yet run out of it being economical. You're finding, any country, take a number of countries, Iran. Iran just increased their oil reserves by a factor of 35% in last year by doing more exploration. Kazakhstan has come online with huge amounts of oil that was not known about 20 years ago when M. King Hubbert wrote his peak curve that we were all going to run out of oil. These predictions about when we're going to run out of oil have never been true. They've been being made since the 1800s. And the reason why oil is going down right now in cost, has been going down since Katrina, is because the world is truly awash in oil. There's a glut of oil around the world. OPEC right now is talking about cutting back production. You take the peak oil theorist Matt Simmons, who wrote a book, Twilight in the Desert, said Saudi Arabia was running out of oil. Saudi Arabia said nonsense. Saudi Arabia published figures where they said they had 1 trillion barrels of reserves. They said they were going to increase their production to 15 million barrels a day. Matt Simmons said they couldn't maintain 10 million barrels a day. They've been maintaining 10 million barrels for 18 months. I've published and linked to WorldNetDaily.com articles I've written and in Black Gold's Stranglehold, the geological structures under Saudi Arabia that show deep fractures in the earth and show the oil pooling up above that. It isn't the case that all the dinosaurs at the end of the Mesozoic era went to Saudi Arabia and died there. It isn't the case that Saudi Arabia uniquely had biological debris in its sedimentary rock. The same sedimentary rock in Saudi Arabia, in whatever era, had biological debris in other places where there was no oil found whatsoever. We have not run out of oil. We're not going to run out of oil. Despite predictions since the 1800s, this peak oil theory was done in the 1950s. We still haven't run out of oil.
Well, we're at the top of the hour. We've run out of time, at least for this hour, but we'll be right back with our two guests, Michael Rupert, Jerry Corsi. And they've kind of like been sitting at a table with us, if you can visualize that. Not really. I'm just saying one's on one side, one's on the other. I'm in the middle. Well, now I'm going to kind of like get up and go, and we're going to let them talk a little bit next hour between each other about this as I throw a few questions. I do want to know what's going on with the Iraqi oil, if it's flowing, and where is it flowing, who's making the money. But next hour, we'll kind of take the gloves off a little bit. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Michael or Jerry, either one of you know what's going on with the Iraqi oil? Is it flowing freely now? And what's happening to the revenue stream?
No, I have been tracking that closely. We just had breaking stories that appear on our website recently that we got from other news organizations. Iraqi production is now at a 20-year low.
And that's as a result of sabotage and damage to the infrastructure following the U.S. occupation. The peak of Iraqi oil production in 1991 was 3.5 million barrels a day. Today it's well below 2 million barrels a day and falling as a result of sabotage.
And in terms of the revenue, where does it go? Is it paying off the war effort? Is it paying us back?
You're going to have to ask Dick Cheney about that. No one seems to know where it's going.
Nobody knows where it's going.
The Iraqi oil situation is a disaster yet, and that country will take a long time to recover. It's same with Iran. Iran has had, since the revolution, its infrastructure has deteriorated, and Iran is producing less oil today than it was in 1979. But there's abundant oil in both countries. One of the points of exception I take is that I don't think we necessarily go to war for the oil in Iraq, because there's abundant oil all over the earth. There's abundant oil in the Gulf. There's abundant oil off the coast. There's abundant oil in Alaska. There's abundant oil that our oil companies, just take a look at Exxon Mobil's annual report. They've never reported either, even for individual companies, Exxon or Mobil or together, as many proven reserves as they currently have. All the major oil companies have more proven reserves today on their balance sheets than ever, and it's not just an accounting issue. They truly have more reserves available.
You had a long segment right before the last break. You made about 10 points, and I've kind of been patiently waiting for my chance to speak to those points right before the last commercial break. I believe that was my turn to do that.
Okay, and I want you two just to feel free now to jump in and chat with each other, so I'm going to let you guys go for now.
Go ahead, Michael.
Well, first of all, you have not mentioned a word about well-documented depletion, which is now occurring in 18 of the 25 largest oil-producing countries in the world. North Sea production is declining at a rate of 10% a year. Norway is in decline. Indonesia, a founding member of OPEC, is now becoming a net oil importer. The government there just recently had to remove subsidies that it was paying for because it couldn't afford them with oil prices as what they are. And gasoline went up 85% overnight, and kerosene, what Indonesians use to cook with, went up 168% overnight. That's an oil-producing country.
Do you want to stop with that much, Michael, so I can respond to it?
Well, let me finish with my points here. You mentioned Mexico's Cantarell. That's one of the three or four largest fields ever discovered on the planet. The Mexican government announced that Cantarell was in decline last year. You quoted Matthew Simmons, who has done some, I think, some excellent work. On page 77 of your book, you quote Matthew Simmons as saying that there are 600 trillion barrels of oil on the planet. Matthew Simmons has never said that. I've spoken to him. Nobody has ever argued there was more of a conventional endowment of oil on the planet than 2 trillion barrels. And you've got him saying 600 trillion?
It's probably a typographical error. It's first edition, and there are some in that book.
Was it a typographical error on page 135 when you wrote that water molecules contain one hydrogen atom bound with 2 oxygen atoms? It's the other way around. Water is 2 hydrogen atoms and 1 oxygen atom. You got that one wrong. On page 144, you list Ecuador as being in Central America. You know, that kind of research is not going to add to your credibility much. And when you talk about Iran,
where would you like to put Ecuador, Michael? Where would you like to put Ecuador?
Ecuador is in South America. It's on the equator. That's where it got its name. It's below. It's south of Colombia in South America, not Central America, where you put it.
Okay. Now you've pointed out some nitpicking issues, and I would like all those. We'll correct the next edition on any of those points. The point about depletion, it's kind of like saying, yes, you can take all the water out of your swimming pool, but it doesn't mean all the swimming pools are out of water. A well will deplete. Also, even as you've pointed out, Michael, many wells that are drilled are only drilled 30 to 50%. There's a lot of oil even left in those wells. Secondly, depletion statistics, even with Saudi Arabia, Matt Simmons, the Saudis disagree with Matt Simmons' analysis. They're continuing to do increasing production, despite the fact that Matt Simmons says they're in decline.
No, they are not, and that's not what he says either. You got to quote him accurately if you're going to quote him.
Well, Twilight in the Desert, the coming Saudi oil shock, I'm holding it in my hand.
He said coming. He didn't say they were in decline now. He said they're on the brink of decline, and they may not be able to increase production above 10 million barrels a day to 12, which is what they're claiming, and they haven't reached 12 yet.
Well, they're very close to it, and they say they're going to 15, and they have increased above 10, which he said was their maximum amount they could produce.
People lie about reserves. People lie all the time, especially Saudi. I wouldn't trust the Saudi government.
They've exceeded the amount that Matt Simmons said was their maximum production. The Saudis already are above that. And my point is that the wells of the world, an individual well may deplete. Now, is Cantarell one well, or is it part of a complex system in the Gulf that is nowhere near depleting? That's what I'm maintaining. I'm maintaining that there are complex well systems deep within the earth that are seeping up, and they're nowhere near depletion.
Oil companies are in the business to make money. They've had 110 years and spent, I don't know, probably hundreds of millions of dollars on the science of geologic exploration to find oil. They go where they can make money. That's what Dick Cheney said to the London Petroleum Institute in 1999 when he said, hey, listen, we have this problem. When we use oil, we have to go find more, and that's getting harder to do. Why then, with all of this expertise and this 100 years of these enormous profits, would the oil companies not have developed something which would have made them more money? Instead, we see Ford on the edge of bankruptcy, GM teetering much closer to bankruptcy. We see 800,000 jobs lost this winter. We see threats of people freezing to death. We see Hugo Chavez of Venezuela offering low-cost oil to keep people warm in Boston. Where's the logic in this?
Michael, the oil companies last year made record profits. They made $100 billion. They're some of the largest profits ever made by any corporation ever in history were made by oil companies last year.
That's true.
Okay, so they're not losing money, and they're putting billions of dollars into oil and natural gas development because they know it's there.
No, they aren't.
Well, they are.
No, they are not. Chevron Texaco, if you go to its website right now, you'll see the Chevron Texaco website talking about peak oil, and they went into a large advertising campaign this year.
Well, the advertising campaigns are a different issue. BP says it's beyond petroleum. It's not. It's British Petroleum, and they're putting billions of dollars everywhere in the world. They're putting it into Nigeria. They are still putting it into the North Sea. They're putting it into Russia. They're putting it all over the world. They're putting it offshore in Brazil. BP has no intention of being beyond petroleum except in its advertising.
Well, you mentioned Russia. I'm looking at 8 articles, and I'm willing to cite the date, time, and publication, whether it's a Russian news agency or BBC or whoever it is. 9 articles saying that Russia will be going over peak by 2010. They may not be able to increase production because they're running out of oil. How do you explain that in light of your reliance on some scientists, Kryushkin number one, who advocates abiotic oil, who has twice refused to show up for peer review? Now, you have a PhD. You understand that peer review is very important for science.
Michael, Russia is the second largest exporter of oil in the world, right?
Yes.
Behind Saudi Arabia.
That's true.
They actually are challenging Saudi Arabia to be the largest producer, and Saudi Arabia has not decreased production. There's no indication whatsoever, except maybe in a few articles you have, that are written by people who still believe M. Hubbard King's napkin drawing of a normal curve.
Now, hold it,
running
hold
out
it,
earth.
Hold it. See, I'm going to sound like Ronald Reagan. There you go again. M. King Hubbard's, as you say in the book, thesis or work on the U.S. domestic oil peak was not back of the napkin. I have held a copy of the original monograph in my hand, and it was so full of calculations I couldn't even look at it.
Now, that was the one he published after he did the napkin. Go look at DeFay's book in which he discusses the lunch at which the original drawing
okay.
was done.
But here's the point. He was right. U.S. oil production peaked in 1970. It has domestic U.S. oil production has never exceeded what it was producing in 1970.
Domestic oil production in the United States peaked because we've quit exploring. Between the environmentalists and the desire to restrain supply, we have stopped going after oil that's abundantly available. How about Alaska?
Well, wait a minute. You have an economy that's collapsing. You have truckers that can't afford to buy diesel fuel for their trucks. You have airlines, several in bankruptcy, Chapter 11 right now because of fuel costs. And you're telling me this is because somebody doesn't want to go look for oil when it's an obvious benefit to the whole economy
to
have the oil?
I'm saying, Michael, that the oil companies like everybody believing it's peak oil, so they can charge more. The oil companies have not built a new refinery in 30 years in the United States.
Well, I'll be happy.
I'd like to have all the tax incentives taken away from the oil industry unless they increase supply.
Oil companies can
increase supply. It's abundantly available. They're sitting on massive reserves of oil that they don't want to come off of until the price is higher.
By the way, I'm still here, guys. I'm listening, just so you know.
Okay. I want to go back to a point, though, about the origin of oil and something that Michael said earlier. I'm arguing that when you take a look at the basic structure of a biological material, which is heavily oxidated, that is not going to increase in energy to a higher molecular form of an advanced hydrocarbon if you bury it and wait a long period of time. I'm going to make the argument very simply. If you take 100 cats and bury them, in 1,000 years you dig them up, no matter how deep you bury them, you're not going to get any oil. Living tissue deteriorates into constituent chemicals. The processes to create advanced hydrocarbons, which are abundantly demonstrated in laboratories, are abiotic processes that are similar to what we do in refining, in which we can create advanced hydrocarbon structures, or creating methane, including carbon-13, because even if you find methane that's carbon-12, it doesn't mean the carbon-13 hasn't fractionated, as that has moved up from within the earth. When we look at the methane that's coming out of the earth in deep sea cracks way down into the earth, it is carbon-13, including carbon-12, but a larger proportion of carbon-13 from the source. So my basic argument is that in a laboratory, it has never been demonstrated that you could take biological material without an abiotic process and produce a higher hydrocarbon form out of it like oil.
Absolutely has. I mean, that's like saying, I can't prove to you that the human body produces urea, but if you give me a couple of beers and a ham sandwich, in about an hour, I'm going to go to the bathroom and produce a lot of urea, and I know where it came from.
No, I'm saying you can, but Wohler demonstrated, and this is a very good point that you bring up, urea. In about 1828, he demonstrated that you could produce urea abiotically. It wasn't required to have somebody drinking beer to produce urea.
But could doesn't mean did.
Products.
Could, the possible, doesn't mean the reality.
No, but it does mean the reality, Michael, because there's nothing magical about a chemical that came from a living thing. A living thing is just constituent chemicals. And the constituent chemicals exist deep within the mantle of the earth, and they combine naturally and produce hydrocarbons.
Do you agree that at 275 degrees, oil cracks into natural gas?
It cracks, yes, it can, and it can crack into other things. You can take a look
right.
at what's going on in refining.
All right.
Take a look at what's done in the process of refining under heat conditions and pressure conditions. You can take a carbon-methane structure or a carbon structure, hydrocarbon structure, and you can evolve it in a variety of different ways, all abiotically.
You can. That doesn't mean it does. Let me go back to my point. I was trying to make a point. You agree that under sufficient heat, oil cracks and gives you natural gas. There's no chemistry outfit or college anywhere in the world that will dispute that. You can replicate that experiment, which is what science is all about, anywhere in the world.
Well, that demonstrates that you can produce methane abiotically, and that's what I've said.
Let me finish. The temperatures in the mantle are so high, they're well above 275 degrees. Now, you would argue that pressure allows the oil not to break, but as the oil migrates up, as the further it migrates up, the more the pressure reduces. You have to pass through a window where the abiotic oil, if it was coming from the mantle, would all convert to natural gas. It would be cracked by itself. It couldn't possibly reach
the surface. Like we get a variety of substances coming out of the earth, forming in the mantle, that come out in a variety of forms. They come out in different ways and different processes. Because you can do it one way doesn't mean that's the only way it's done.
Science is science.
Lava,
you cook oil at a certain temperature, it's going to crack. And it's got to pass through that temperature window to get to the surface.
Michael, you can have structures of hydrocarbons that have been demonstrated to be produced. I mean, go take a look at what's coming out of the earth right now in the sea vents. You've got abiotic methane coming out right there.
We've already been there, and I have agreed with you on that.
Okay,
and the amount is less than the amount produced by cow farts every year. That's not commercially viable.
Michael, it is increasingly commercially viable. Otherwise, you would not have the U.S. Department of Energy with a deep track project encouraging people to go drill under 3 miles down to 8 miles, and the technology's there. They demonstrate the technology right on the site of advanced drills that are able effectively to get that oil out. 20 years ago, you couldn't have gotten oil out of the Gulf.
As far as I know, no well has ever been drilled deeper than 6 or 7 miles.
Well,
because the casings get crushed and the heat melts.
They've gone down between 8 and 10. Okay, they have gone down that far, and they're finding oil down that far.
Where?
Abundantly.
Well, name a field.
Well,
one field. Just name one.
Well, okay, right off of Vietnam, the Tiger fields right off of Vietnam are down that deep. Petro-Vietnam is with the Russians using abiotic theories are down that deep.
How much are they producing?
I don't know the exact current figures. It's over 1 million barrels a day from some of their major fields. It's abundant there, and that's in volcanic rock.
There's no
sedimentary rock there at all.
No, yes, there is. There is sedimentary rock around, and that's where you have to go back to plate tectonics.
It is not sedimentary rock.
Which can fold igneous rock and hard rock on top of sedimentary layers as a result of the continental plates moving. And that happens all the time. It's happened in the Gulf of Mexico.
Michael, this is down to bedrock. I've written articles on it, WorldNet Daily. I've cited the geological studies. They're all there. It's bedrock. It's not sedimentary rock.
I'm back in for a little bit, guys. I had to go out and fill up my car before and fuel it up for my trip home. I want to continue this discussion with both of you when we come back. But I want you to think about this, too, for a moment. The price of diamonds inflated. They shouldn't be what they are. When guys buy diamonds for their loved ones, they should be a little cheaper. I think that there's a control there. Think about this. Are they controlling oil to keep the price up? Can they produce, whether it's abiotic or whether it's a fossil fuel, are they controlling it to keep the price up? Think about that when we come back. And if you haven't been to their websites, we'll do so. Jerry Corsi's website is atomiciran.com. You've got a couple books out there, Black Gold Stranglehold, Atomic Iran, and Michael Rupert, of course. You can go to his website. That's fromthewilderness.com, and that will show you all the things he has written and done and researched. Both of them will end up coming back to Coast to Coast. Jerry Corsi, an expert on the Iranian situation. Michael Rupert, of course, has a varied background, 9/11 and some other issues as well. So we'll be bringing them both back for individual complete shows. But when we come right back, we'll continue our debate on oil. And the next hour, we'll open it up for you. Phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to the Great Debate with Jerry Corsi and Michael Rupert. Both of you gentlemen, do you think the oil companies manipulate the price on all of us? Let's start with you, Michael.
Well, he raised a good point that I'd like to address in the last thing, and it has to do with the oil companies. He mentioned that the oil companies are not building more refineries. That's absolutely correct. Matthew Simmons addressed that. He's the world's largest energy investment banker. His clients include Kerr McGee, the World Bank, even Halliburton. And I like Matt in spite of all of that. But he dissented from Vice President Cheney's Energy Task Force report in 2001. And he said basically that the investments are not going to be made because the return on investment is uncertain. If it costs you $150 million, $200 million, to build a new refinery, and you know that there's not going to be enough oil to be refined there to pay off the refinery, you would not make the investment. And that's exactly what we see happening in the grid right now. We see that was one of the causes of the 2003 blackout. The return on investment is uncertain. Again, oil companies are in business to make money, and they have made these enormous profits over the last 3 or 4 years. And this is from their own corporate reports like Chevron and ExxonMobil and Total. Because there's no place left to explore. There's no place left to look for oil. They aren't investing in drilling. He mentioned Kazakhstan. The 20 out of the first 25 wells drilled in Kazakhstan were dry holes. The first well cost $125 million.
Just for one?
For one well. That's the first well. Now, ExxonMobil has pulled out. Statoil, the largest oil company in Norway, a major oil producer, has pulled out. All the majors are pulling out. There's only maybe 40 billion barrels of recoverable oil in the whole Caspian Sea basin, and it's all heavy sour oil. Which is full of sulfur. It's very expensive to refine. It's very polluting. All the Western oil companies and the U.S. majors have pulled out, except for Chevron, which is still in Tengiz, because it's just not cost-effective to try to get that oil out, and there's not enough there to make a difference.
Okay, but if the price were up, if it were higher, mm-hmm. would they try for it?
Now, and let me get in on this, too. The issue of the oil companies, the poor oil companies, can't find any more oil. Oil companies made $100 billion a year last year. That was record profits. It isn't because they couldn't find any oil. They're sitting on record reserves. Just take a look at any one of their annual reports. There's billions of barrels of reserves. They're keeping in the ground until the price is higher. After Katrina, the price started falling. The oil companies could have continued charging more. They'd have gone for more than $100 billion. The reason they restrained and got back into a market price was because they were afraid Congress was going to start charging windfall taxes the same way Congress did in the 70s when the oil companies got out of hand with excess profits before. It's just not the case that the oil companies do not have reserves that are available. There's oil all over the world, abundantly available.
Somebody should tell them where it is.
Well, we have. I mean, I've documented it in Black Gold Stranglehold. Go to the Energy Information Administration's reports country by country. You can take country by country. Saudi Arabia has more reserves than they had before, and they're pumping more.
No, they are not.
Yes, they are. They're pumping.
They're 10 million barrels a day.
They're now at 11 point something million a day. They're over 10 million a day. And they're headed, they say, to 15 million barrels a day. OPEC had a meeting. The last reserve meeting in OPEC, they want to cut production. In fact, Iran has a major proposal on the table now for OPEC to cut production. Why? Iran wants to jack the price of oil up again so they make more money that they can put into terrorism and their nuclear program.
You have mentioned Katrina several times. I'd like to comment on that. The reason why oil prices have fallen after Katrina has nothing to do either with the damage that Katrina still has left in the Gulf. It has to do with the fact that President Bush opened the Strategic Petroleum Reserves and released, I think it was 60 million barrels, plus the OECD, Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, of which there are, I think, 22 member nations, opened their petroleum reserves and flooded the U.S. with refined gasoline. Now, the market plays on this. There's a lot of profiteering going on in the market.
Michael, the amount that was released there is insignificant in relationship to what's being consumed every day. The reason the price went down after Katrina is because worldwide, not only in the spot markets, but worldwide, at $55 a barrel, there's a glut of oil. At $65 a oil, it only can be sustained in times of crisis.
Well, we're almost at 65 again, in case you haven't noticed. Oil is climbing back up right now.
Over the last 3 days, it spiked over Iran being referred to the Security Council. Prior to that, it was not spiking. It spikes in crises. And restraining the supply, which the oil companies have done by not building refineries, is not because refineries aren't profitable. It's because they do not want to have more supply into the market so they can charge more for what they are putting into the market.
Give me your perspective, both of you, on this situation with Iran. Now, Jerry, you've studied Iran quite heavily, especially in your book, Atomic Iran. You were on just a few weeks ago as we were talking about the possibility of what happens when they continue their nuclear program, which is what they're doing now. Here's my question to both of you. And again, I want to stay out of this. It's tough for me to do that, but I want to. Do you believe, Michael Rupert, do you believe our potential intervention into Iran, and I think it will happen, is based on going to take their oil fields, as has probably happened in Iraq, or do we really want to take out those nuclear facilities?
We wouldn't be able, under any circumstances, to occupy Iraq Iran. And take over their oil production any better than we were able to do so with Iraq, which is where the production has fallen dramatically as a result of sabotage. And believe me, Iran is no Iraq. They are a very strong country. They're militarily sound. They've just purchased SAM-17s from Russia. They haven't had a war since the end of the Iran-Iraq war. Their military is intact. Their command and control is intact. I, for one, am terrified of an Israeli or a U.S. attack on Iran, and the reason why is very clear. China has just last year committed to $200 billion in investment in Iran, $140 billion for oil, $60 million for gas, I believe it is. The world, which includes Europe, which includes Malaysia, India, China, cannot do without Iranian oil. There's no place else to go to get the oil.
But you've got a elected official there claiming that he'll blow Israel off the map.
Right.
He says the Holocaust never occurred, and he goes on and on and on. And now they're so close to possibly, they say within 3 months, they'll have the ability to have a nuclear weapon if they don't have it already.
The reports I've seen say 2 years, but I acknowledge that's something to be concerned
about.
But it's
a real problem.
Exactly. It's a real problem, and if they get nuclear weapons, they have a history of being a terrorist country. Now, in terms of what Michael's shifting
around. One more concern about Iran, it's not just what they could do. They could easily give this weaponry
Absolutely.
To Al-Qaeda.
I've been desperately concerned about Iran for going on to over 2 years. I've been writing about it. I wrote Atomic Iran. I'm writing another book on Iran. If Iran gets nuclear weapons, we're going to have a nuclear war.
Are we taking Iranian oil in an indirect way?
No, I mean, we may have some that comes through in a fungible way to the United States, but Iran it produces under 4 million barrels a day. The Iranian oil production is insignificant in the world.
You agree with that, Michael Rupert?
I wouldn't say it's insignificant. No,
it is under 4 million barrels a day.
They are ranked in the top 5 oil producers in the world.
No, it's ranked in the top 5 countries with reserves.
No, production. Top 5 oil exporters.
Okay, it's producing under 4 million barrels a day.
But
we're taking in 1.75 million barrels a day from Mexico. We're taking in 1.3 million barrels a day from Venezuela. We're taking in, in terms of the oil production worldwide coming out of Iran, it's not enough. Just like with Iraq coming off of the market, it's no shortage of oil that's caused Iraq to come off of the market. Iraq has abundant oil. It's the disruption that the war has caused to its infrastructure, and the Iraqi oil coming off the market has not disrupted the price. The price has been restrained artificially by the large companies. And in the United States, it's been restrained because
the price of oil has gone up 300% since 2001. You can't say
Michael,
taking Iraqi oil off the market hasn't made a difference.
Michael, so are the prices of housing, in case you haven't noticed.
Well, housing is different.
Prices in the United States have ratcheted up in stepwise fashion, whether the government says there's inflation or not. We've experienced stepwise price increases, both in energy and in housing.
I'm sorry, but that's absolute nonsense.
All right, here's the order.
We have an economy sustained by a housing boom. As the housing prices go up, people borrow against it to buy more consumer goods.
The prices of housing are going up.
As gasoline prices go up, people lose their jobs.
Here's the order, by the way, of countries that produce the most oil based on OPEC now. These are OPEC members. Russia, Saudi Arabia, they're very close. The United States is third, Iran is 4, and
yep.
China is 5th. Do you agree with that? This was a 2004 bulletin.
China's not 5th.
I wouldn't think we were way up there. We're 3rd. That doesn't make sense.
No, it's not. I don't think that's correct. I have a better chart on my website. Maybe I can find it at the next break.
This is an OPEC website. It says which countries produce the most oil based on 2004.
No, I don't know what the source is, but China became a net oil importer about 3 years ago. It's now the second largest oil consumer on the planet after the U.S., they're scouring the world for energy right now. They're even investing in Canada, and they tried to buy a Unocal. That's a clue.
And they're going offshore China looking for deep oil off in the China Sea, which they're most likely going to find. And they're most likely going to be able to find additional oil in China when they look deeper in areas like Russia has done. Now, Russia didn't produce any oil hardly at the end of World War II until it began using the abiotic theories and looking deeper. And it's now, as those numbers just showed, the second largest oil exporter in the world.
Hold it. I got to call you up there, man. You got that one wrong again, too. I got 9 articles sitting in front of me from
Michael, you could have 150 in front of you.
Various sources that say very clearly that Russian oil production is nearing a peak and they're going to have to cut, reduce exports by 2010 at the latest.
Michael, I'll send you 50 articles from the U.S. Geological Service from the 1890s through 1950 saying we hit peak oil.
Well, you keep using data that's 10, 12, 15 years old. We need current data.
No, Michael, I'm not using data that's that old. I'm using data that's current that you say you can't find.
And no, no.
1.28 trillion barrels of proven reserves worldwide.
Nobody has said that Russian oil is abiotic.
Pardon me?
I don't think even you say that the Russian oil that's being produced is abiotic.
I'm saying that all the oil being produced is abiotic.
Oh,
I'm saying that there is no demonstration that oil is a biological product. I'm just saying that that is hoax science. It's a myth. It's like saying that the sun revolves around the earth. You can produce all the articles you want.
Well, anyways, back to the original question that neither one of you has answered yet. Do you think the big oil companies are inflating prices on us?
Yes.
I would qualify that and say yes, but I would say that there is always market play that's involved for mid-range players and, you know, people in the financial markets who will trade oil as a commodity or as a derivative. You know, they'll trade oil futures and so forth, and that will have an effect on price, yes. However, there is an underlying reality to all this, which is the scarcity of oil, which is in the planet's face everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You've got 18 nations in decline. Britain has a problem paying unemployment insurance for all the North Sea oil field workers who are out of work because the North Sea is crashing. And that's happening all over the world. Alaska, the North Slope, is full of ghost towns. Production from the North Slope in Alaska peaked in the early to mid-1980s. It's been in months.
A lot of the oil, even Alaska, has been left in the ground. It will be drawn out with greater technology. Alaska's only been in a tiny bit explored.
So we want United Airlines to go bankrupt and Delta to go bankrupt and GM to go bankrupt. We want...
Well, the oil companies don't care who gives. As long as they're making $100 billion, it's fine if every trucker listening to us tonight can't make a living. The oil companies are happy with that.
Well, then the oil companies
are profits.
Are going to go out of business, too, if the economy crashes.
What's going on with this Hugo Chavez guy in Venezuela? I mean, here he is providing fuel, oil, to Maine at a 40% discount. Massachusetts, he's given it to the Bronx in New York.
And to his own people at 40 cents a gallon.
I mean, what's going on with this guy when, you know, our government can't stand him and wants him out, reportedly, and yet he's helping us. None of the other oil companies are. I don't understand it.
Chavez has got a public relations stunt on that. He's giving the oil to his own people at 40 cents a gallon. He knows he can get the revenue, which is to him completely windfall revenue.
From other countries.
Selling it on the world market at the highest dollar possible, where he's selling the majority of his oil. That's what's happening worldwide. Reserves have been held worldwide until the price is higher.
Do you think his benevolence here in this country
is public relations?
But at least Americans are benefiting by it.
Fine. I hope he does. I wish he would give all of his oil away to that price.
I've got to ask a question here. What event, if all of these oil reserves, these billions and trillions and whatever barrels of infinitely never-exhausting reserves...
You're saying that, hidden. Michael, is just as if you're trying to ridicule the idea.
What's going to trigger somebody...
I'm saying, Michael, we've had reports now going back to the 1890s that we're going to run out of oil, and they never come to be true. We still have more oil than ever, and you're still publishing reports that we've hit peak oil.
What's going to make somebody produce all this abiotic oil? How bad do things have to get?
It's being produced. It's being produced constantly, and the oil consumption has doubled since 1970, and we still have more proven reserves than ever in history.
No, I just read Jimmy Carter's speech. We were at like 70 million barrels a day in 1970. We're at 84 million barrels.
Hey, Jimmy Carter said we were going to have no more oil production by 1985. I'll show you the speech. It's right after his malaise speech.
Okay, so he missed the date.
Yeah, right. That's the problem with peak oil. Every time we miss a date, you just push it out.
Well, wait a minute. Hold
push it out 200 years.
No.
We're never going to run out
You're
of oil.
You're pulling the dinosaur thing on me. Not I, not Matthew Simmons, not Colin Campbell, not Kiel Aliklet, not any of the eminent scientists, not Kenneth DeFays of Princeton University has, well, he's, DeFays has come closest and said, Thanksgiving 2005.
Yeah, and that, we've passed that. We haven't run out of oil.
No,
every one of these
it's
days.
Not running out of oil.
Michael,
it's peaking.
I'll send you.
We all say that no one will know when peak occurs until we see it in
Michael,
the rearview mirror.
I'll send you 250 articles that were all wrong on the dates that we were going to have.
Yeah, but
peak
I'm
oil.
Not offering a date, and no peak oil theorist is
you
offering
can't,
a date.
Because we're not going to run out of oil. There'll never be a date except in your head.
Well, Michael, you did say we weren't going to run out of oil.
You did, Michael.
Nobody's saying I didn't say that. The issue is peak.
Okay.
The issue is when this planet and this species and this global economic paradigm, which depends upon energy to sustain economic growth, reaches a point where supplies of oil begin to diminish in the face of increasing demand. This is where the conflict comes. Nobody, I've never said we're going to run out of oil.
All right, stay with us. You're both doing a great job here. Michael Rupert, our guest, along with Jerry Corsi. We're going to continue this debate, and we're also going to include you now. We'll take your questions. So when you call in, if you would just tell Tommy who you would like to address your question to, that would make it a little easier. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment. On Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Jerry Corsi and Mike Rupert and your phone calls for the rest of this hour. Then at the end of this program, we'll wrap things up, let them both make a statement. Jerry Corsi will go last. Michael went first in the beginning of the show. And maybe we'll open up Fast Blasts in a half hour and take our very unofficial poll on just what you think about the topic we've been talking about tonight. Michael, how long and what was your interest in investigating oil? How did that all come about for you?
I had paid very, very little attention to peak oil or the issues around peak oil until after the attacks of September the 11th. It was shortly after that that a geologist and a very talented writer named Dale Allen Pfeiffer approached me with some of the background, the long background history on peak oil. And as I started looking at it, it made sense because I have written in my book, Crossing the Rubicon, that 9/11 was absolutely an inside job created by the Bush administration as a pretext to start this global sequential war to control the last remaining oil reserves on the planet, and that's literally what we have seen and are seeing. And so that prompted me to look at it as a motive to explain what was going on. I'm a former detective, and I was loaned to homicide for a short time, but in a homicide case, you got to prove means, motive, and opportunity. And in order for something as horrendous as 9/11 to have happened, you needed a motive that was equally big. That's the way you look at it from a legal standpoint in court. And peak oil worked to do that, and it has continued to work. Plus, it's given me a map to be able to really accurately predict world events. And I have to come back again to the point that, you know, the world is totally behaving as if peak oil was real. So that theory is being validated by what I see in front of my eyes.
Well, I agree with that, and I think Jerry would agree that if the world is behaving that way. Jerry?
Well, I think peak oil, the motive for peak oil is obvious. It's for oil companies to be able to charge more. I mean, it's clear that peak oil is a theory that the oil companies want everybody to believe. And if the peak oil theorists supporting the oil companies together with the environmentalists can restrain supply, not build any new refineries, that's a good way to keep prices high. My interest in this started when I was a kid. I remember in the 50s, when I was a kid, reading articles in science magazines in the library where the Russians were finding oil down 6, 7, 8 miles below the surface of the Earth. And that fascinated me. Ever since then, I've gotten and read everything I could get my hands on about it. And after I wrote the book in Iran and getting into the politics of oil, realizing Iran had $200 million a day in oil revenue with oil prices spiking the way they have to fund terrorism and their nuclear program, I decided I needed to really focus and write a book exposing the abiotic theory so people had in their hands that there was alternative science around that said the Earth does produce oil and natural gas on a constant basis.
I'd like to ask the question.
And also, Michael, I just want you to know, I'm not going to skim over, I have to skim over your theories on 9/11. That's a separate show probably later on. Big issue. Go ahead.
I'd like to ask a question. What Mr. Corsi just said was that the oil companies are deliberately trying to raise the prices higher and higher and higher to eke more profits. That seems to be working on the assumption, maybe I didn't understand something, that the American worker can continue to afford to pay more and more and more as if there's an abiotic paycheck for people to pay for this oil.
Michael, how is that sustainable?
I mean, the Council on Foreign Relations says for the past 50 years,
they can get away with raising it. If they can raise it to $3 a gallon, they'll do it. If Congress starts saying they'll do windfall taxes, they back down from it. They'll raise it as high as they can get away. They made $100 billion a year last year, some of the greatest corporate profits ever made in the history of capitalism. They're not shy about making money when they can.
But the fact is, recessions curb demand. That's totally documented.
We're nowhere
because
near
unemployed
a
people don't take trips. They don't fly on airplanes.
We're
they don't drive cars.
The stock market just hit 11,000. The oil companies are ramping up to charge more for oil as soon as they can.
We'll drop just a little bit today because of Iran. Let's take some calls. We'll come back to it, okay? People are lining up here. Let's go to our East of the Rockies line. Welcome to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is Mark calling from Florida.
Mark, welcome. Go ahead.
Thank you. I guess my question would be more towards Michael. Actually, I'm not sure whichever one may have the
Well, let's throw it out first and see who it is going to apply to.
Okay. Well, if you'll give me just a second to articulate it. It's only one question, but it's kind of multifaceted.
All right.
I'm an investigator by nature, too, and I have no education beyond college chemistry and physics. So whether it's abiotic or biological, I'm having a difficult time understanding if it's biological, why don't we see, for instance, I'm an outdoorsman. I see a decayed carcass in the woods. I see bugs toting away the biological material as it decays and the bones dry. And eventually it just, how was there so many dinosaurs that, is there something different about dinosaur flesh that,
let me take two miles down
into the earth and then concentrate into a pool? And then be taken up, and if we're using so many million barrels a day, how many dinosaurs did there need to be to produce that much
Let's go back to where we started the show. Nobody says that oil came from dinosaurs. That is a common myth.
Oil said it.
Nobody has argued, and I'm not arguing, that oil came from dinosaurs. We got to stop that.
Forget the dinosaurs. 20-minute segment of the show.
I figured that. But what it is an accumulation of algae, plankton, which the oceans were filled with. Let's say, for example, you put some butter down in a pan and then you throw some flour on it. If you cook those ingredients at the right temperature and the right pressure, you will get a chemical reaction which is reproducible in the laboratory. It's not about dead dinosaur flesh laying down. It's about stuff that was deposited underwater and then layers of sediment were rolled over it.
That's not where the Russian scientists started in the 1700s. They did say dinosaurs, and the caller called in because that's what's in the public imagination. It's been said since the 1700s, including by the oil companies. It's why it's called fossil fuel. Your caller also had a very good point. You know, I've buried a lot of people in my life, in family, many of whom it was horrible to bury, and I didn't worry about a single one of them turning into oil. No matter how deep they were buried nor how long.
I'm not saying that they do.
Biological material deteriorates into constituent chemicals.
I'm saying too much oxygen.
It's got too much oxygen in it ever to form a higher hydrocarbon.
How much decayed matter would it take, let's say, to make a barrel of oil?
I couldn't tell you. That's way above my head.
Yeah, me too.
A bunch of biological material will never make a barrel of oil put in the ground and allowed to decay.
That's where the oil came from.
To it, you might transform it into oil with chemicals, like in the Fischer-Tropsch process, but it won't naturally decay into oil.
Let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on the air with us. Hi.
Hi. Can you hear me?
We sure can. Loud and clear.
Okay, good. My name is Paula. I'm calling from Bellefonte, Pennsylvania. My question is for Dr. Corsi.
All right.
I'm wondering if you can explain the geochemical process by which abiotic oil is formed, and how is it that the carbon is cycled through the Earth systems enough so that we would have a seemingly infinite supply of oil. Excuse me.
Okay, and I'll let you take it off the air.
The hydrogen and carbon combines in the mantle of the Earth, and it forms various hydrocarbon structures. We've talked about methane. We've talked about how methane can evolve into other higher hydrocarbon structures with the proper heat and temperature and pressure, similar to refining. Gasoline, that those processes are well understood. A lot of abiotic processes understood that can produce diesel fuel and gasoline. I'm not sure if her question was aimed at carbon 12 and carbon 13, but carbon fractionates because you've got a process of methane that's carbon 12 doesn't mean it hadn't fractionated, so that originally its source was much more carbon 13. That's a pretty technical answer, but what I'm saying is there's good evidence that methane is abiotic. There's a lot of good evidence that you can produce abiotic diesel fuel, gasoline, etc., without any decaying plankton or life forms of any other kind.
Okay. Thanks for that response. What, west of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Good evening, George. This is Blair in Sedona, Arizona.
Hi, Blair.
First of all, blessings on Ramona Bell's soul.
Okay, thank you.
I have a question concerning the Illuminati, which any definition, it could be something from behind the scenes, and this is going to be directed to Michael Rupert.
All right.
Why do we war? Because it's immensely profitable, Michael. You mentioned about the CIA, illegal drug trail, drugs propping up Wall Street. And it's sort of one of those conundrums is that might keep our individual freedoms. No chip implanted if we lose the cash flow for Wall Street with this drug dealing. You get where I'm going with this?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, let me say, and this is no offense to you, that I never write about or discuss the Illuminati because I can't prove that they exist. I'm a trained detective, and I have found no evidence to say that they exist. That's not to say that they don't. I just don't go to where I can't prove. Your point is a good one. A lot of people have asked me about things like concentration camps being built, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, no, it's way too expensive. I've been in government. I mean, it costs money to build concentration camps and Manila guards out in the boonies. It's much more economically productive for the financial markets, since we live in an economic paradigm of infinite growth and an economy which actually makes more money by killing things than it does by saving them, to have a cheap, unemployed migrant labor force prowling the country looking for work. That way you don't have to pay to feed and house them. So this is the simplest solution.
Short-term solutions all.
Yeah.
You know, and it's one of those situations where if we have to change a paradigm, and I think you mentioned that earlier, you know, shifting into a more spiritual mode. And, George, may I make one more comment?
Yes, you may.
Might Premier Radio Networks look into an old-fashioned landline connections via telephone numbers, you know, distributed to your affiliates as insurance relating to satellite failures? You know,
we have that. We have that.
Oh, that's fabulous.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for your time, and this is a great show. Mr. Corsi, your points are fascinating.
Thank you.
Okay, appreciate that. Next up, let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast, you're on the air. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Yeah.
This is Bill from Aberdeen, South Dakota.
Hello, Bill. Welcome to the show, and who's this one for?
This is for both Michael and Jerry.
Okay.
I just want to know if either one of them had any input on cold bed methane.
Well, sure. We have published a lot of stories about cold bed methane on our website at From the Wilderness. All of them academically footnoted. And basically, cold bed methane is becoming a viable alternative in as energy prices continue to rise, but it has a number of problems. It's extremely destructive to the environment. Ranchers in Colorado have taken up rifles to shoot at cold bed methane guys. It's very destructive of the landscape, and it requires enormous quantities of fresh water, of which there's a shortage. So it's one of those things that there are no magic bullets anywhere. We need a lot of, this is not my line, magic BBs, lots of them. And this is something that's going to be turned to, but it's not going to come without a price.
I'll just comment in terms of a slightly different angle. Methane hydrates, which are extremely abundant,
mm-hmm.
That we're only really now getting an ability to learn how to handle. I'd say that when methane hydrates are able to be dealt with, which is soon, it's going to be a very abundant source of natural energy, And again, I maintain that they're abiotic.
Well, we've been doing the abiotic thing, but let me talk about methane hydrates. It's very important. Yes, methane hydrates are all over the place. There's lots of them. The problem is that they are literally like little cubes of methane, little particles of methane ice in the seabed floor. So what you have to do is to melt the seabed floor to extract the methane. And the problem is they found no way to capture the gas. And methane is 40 times more intense a greenhouse gas than is carbon dioxide.
Well, the technology is coming online to be able to get methane hydrates into methane.
Nobody,
I was just at
the ESPO conference in Denver, and there were guys. That,
I'll send it to you. Then.
Okay, I would love to.
It is one of the aspects. One of the reasons why peak oil theories, just like peak coal theories, like peak lumber theories, which are predominant in the energy business, are never true, is because new technologies do come online that make the availability of resources that previously were either not known how to be captured or too expensive available. And methane hydrates, I think, is going to become one of the diversifications, just like natural gas and liquefied natural gas, which 15 years ago were an insignificant part of the market. And today the technology has developed, so they're a very large part of the market and growing.
Well, I can lock you in a bank vault and with all the money in the world, and you will not be able to produce a ham sandwich without a pig. Sorry.
I don't know how that has to do with oil, but I'm sure it has a point.
Money does not create energy. Energy creates money.
No, that wasn't my point. My point was that as science advances, things that previously were unachievable become achievable. Today we know how to make liquefied natural gas economical. It is online. It is increasing online. When I was a kid, they burned off natural gas. They didn't use it at all.
You know why we're going to LNG?
Because it's
of depletion.
Effective, it's abundant, it's cheap.
No. LNG is not abundant. Hold it. That's bad information, and people's lives are at stake here. LNG is not abundant, and it's manufactured product. It's very energy intensive to liquefy natural gas and to regasify it once you transport it, and you transport it on a bomb.
We'll argue about that until 1980s. No one even knew about the Barnett Shale. Barnett Shale has got 128 trillion cubic feet of natural gas in it. People did not know about deep earth methane. Deep Trek in the United States Department of Energy is a whole project to go after that under 3 miles down.
All right, next up, let's go to our, who's up next? East of the Rockies line, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
How you doing?
Good, thank you. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm on?
Yeah, you sure are.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Okay, fellas, very interesting show. Listen, if the planet Earth is an ecosystem,
mm-hmm.
I'm listening to like the core temperatures and the mantle and everything else, and if the Earth is producing its own oil, what if it's producing the oil as like an antifreeze to keep it cool for the outer thing? If we're pumping all this oil out. Has anybody ever, like, brought that up, or...?
No, oil burns. I mean, oil would have no cooling effect under those pressures. It wouldn't even act as a lubricant, no.
I think the point, though, is a good one in terms of ecosystems. The Earth produces many things. I'm maintaining, we've maintained methane and oil, just like, you know, we're not going to run out of oxygen, we're not going to run out of the air, we don't run out of food, despite what Malthus said, that we were going to have a greater population than we have food. All of these resources have not run out or exhausted. I can't think of a single mineral that the Earth produces that we use that we've run out of.
Shortages happening all over the world. Sorry.
Well, I have a father-in-law up in Canada. He's a chemical engineer that's worked on the sands up there. He was part of that plan, and... my cousin is a geologist with the oil companies. I can't wait. I'm glad my computer is recording all of this while I'm at work, but I can't wait to send the show off to him and let him listen to it. I appreciate it, fellas. It was a great show.
Okay, appreciate
Thank
it. You. Why isn't Big Oil trying to help the struggling United States automobile industry?
That's a great question.
Because they want to make profit for their shareholders, not the automobile shareholders.
But Big Oil don't make profits unless Big Oil gets put in the new GM cars.
They're not going to lower the price to subsidize the automobile industry. I'm sorry. They're going to say to the automobile industry, get more efficient. whatever, but it's not their concern. They are going to charge as high a price as they can for gasoline, and when they made $100 billion last year, they didn't seem real concerned that Ford or GM or anybody else had a difficult time.
Stay with us. We'll be back. We're going to wrap things up. We'll take final phone calls. We'll get final statements because this last half hour will zoom by. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment with Jerry Corsi and Michael Rupert and you on Coast to Coast AM. It'll be Friday the 13th when we have our next open line, so get ready for that on our next program. Plus, it'll be a day before the full moon, so anything could happen. I'm going to open up Fast Blasts, and though this is the unofficial poll, the accuracy rate is plus or minus 89%. I want you just to simply tell me Jerry Corsi or Michael Rupert, that's the one you select, and I'll just rally them all up, and we'll give you the results at the end of this hour. We'll be back with the rest of your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. We'll take some more calls. We'll make final statements out of our two guests. I should have by the end of this hour just a little poll for you from Fast Blast to see who you thought had the better of this debate. And it is a compelling issue, no doubt about that. And I'm not so sure, Michael or Jerry, if we'll ever get the real answer. You both present factual and interesting arguments. Let's just hope whatever happens, the oil keeps flowing for now, huh?
I'll say amen to that.
Amen to that.
Let's move on. Wild Card Line, it's your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
My name is Mike. I'm from Tacoma, Washington. I'm calling to ask Jerome Corsi a question and make a comment to Michael Rupert.
All right.
My question here for Jerome is if peak oil is a myth and your claim that there is an endless amount of oil on this earth, how can you explain why several nations such as China, Britain, the United States, and other European nations are making a mad scramble and behaving as if oil is in a short supply? And also, if your theory about the oil companies are gouging us and there's plenty of oil, they're just doing it for profit, why is it then that Americans are going bankrupt? Wouldn't they take that into account, that we need money to buy their oil at expensive prices?
In terms of countries wanting oil, it's kind of like a patient who goes into a hospital, a wealthy patient, gets all the oxygen in the hospital put into their room. They might not need it, but they sure want it available in case they do. So I think countries behave like they want to grab everything, whether they absolutely need it or not. Secondly, in terms of the oil companies and profits, they made $100 billion a year last year. I don't recall them setting aside any for poverty people or to reimburse the truckers on the road that had to pay exorbitant gasoline prices and diesel fuel prices. I see them crying over the automobile companies that were suffering or their shareholders. It is a business. And as long as people believe peak oil is the case, that we're running out, they can charge more for it.
Okay.
Okay.
Live with that?
My comment for Michael is, I've been following your webpage and your videos, and I really respect what you have to say.
Thanks.
When I went to Iraq and Afghanistan, I totally believe that we went there for oil. Why? Because my commanders, my mission was totally geared towards securing oil wells and oil pipelines. And that, to me, was direct evidence of why our mission and what we were really doing there wasn't to liberate Iraqis or find weapons of mass destruction. And secondly, my hat's off to you. You're a true patriot. Keep the fight. You, Cynthia McKinney, Stan Goff, Catherine Austin Fitz, Jeremy Hyatt, and all your people there from the wilderness. Hoo-yah.
All I can say to that is a deep and heartfelt thank you, and tell you, my brother, that you are not alone. I don't discuss my subscribers, but there are many military ranks represented from all services who are subscribers, who get it, and who feel the same way you do. God bless you.
First time caller line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening, sir.
My name's Richard. I'm from Oregon, Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
Listening to you on 1310 WIBA out of the People's Republic of Medicine.
Great.
And Mr. Corsi, my first comment, I bought your book immediately, almost right in the middle of the show you're with Mr. Smith.
Thank you.
And my neighbor's got it right now. And the question I have for you is, one of the solutions that you mentioned, I think either in the last chapter or second to last, was about applying the gold standard again to the dollar. And to Mr. Rupert, I absolutely, totally, positively agree about the alternative fuels. It takes energy to make energy, and myself working in the trucking industry, I've seen the effects of alternative energy used in trucks, and it's not very good.
They aren't good solutions, are they? No.
No, they're not, because I've heard guys complain when they use diesel fuel with a 5% biodiesel mixture that it's messed up badly their injectors, and on the mechanical sense, it's not very good at all, other than, you know, the fact that right now we're using low sulfur diesel, and I guess sometime next year we're going to be going to an ultra low sulfur diesel, which doesn't, you know, help mileage or anything like that at all.
We wouldn't be taking these measures unless it were necessary, because it's obviously harming people. And if more people have jobs and you make more money trucking, you have more money to spend on gasoline or on anything else that you choose to spend it on, which is what keeps the economy going. And so that's the rub. We wouldn't be doing this unless it was necessary.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and then, Mr. Corsi, your answer about that, reapplying the dollar to the gold standard?
Right. We brought up the gold standard because the Islamic countries have reintroduced the gold dinar. And there's a major move to do all oil settlements in the gold dinar. Iran is pushing that very strong. If that happens, oil now internationally is settled in the dollar. We sell a lot of our treasury debt into those dollars. And we try to warn the American people that there is a crisis coming. There's a political crisis that we're vulnerable to if we don't reexamine the issue of having at least a foreign exchange dollar in gold backing that we can use to settle oil transactions worldwide.
Okay, great. Thank you for that. I'm still tabulating here. Should have them in about 10 minutes or so.
Five-second follow-up to what Jerome said.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
I think that Iran's greatest crime is not that it might be producing a nuclear weapon. Iran is going to open its oil bourse trading in euros in March. And March is coincidentally the month when the deadlines fall due from Israel and Europe to go to the U.N.
Iran is an extremely dangerous country in about 10 ways I can think of. And their whole challenge to the U.S. dollar is going to be a major challenge I expect to have unfold at the end of this year, 2006. And they're in the process of launching it at the same time they're pushing for nuclear weapons. They're an extremely dangerous country.
Okay, thank you. Let's go to our West of the Rockies line. You're up on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Yeah, hi. It's Bruce in Los Angeles.
Hi, Bruce.
Earlier, you gentlemen were discussing shortages of things in general. Specifically, Michael, concerning food shortages all over the world. In my opinion, and I follow, and this question really is ultimately for Jerry, the philosophy of Julian Simon, the late, great Julian Simon.
Who I tremendously admire.
Yes, wonderful man. All shortages, and also Thomas Sowell, too.
Yes.
All shortages are man-made, created.
Correct.
Russia did not have rubber boots, not because there was not enough rubber or boots. It's because their economic system was completely corrupt, upside down, and non-user-friendly, so to speak. Pure capitalism, as Julian Simon believed, and had a bet with Ehrlich about the population bomb and everything.
That's right. Ehrlich lost the bet.
Absolutely lost it. He bet on any, four or five minerals.
He bet on five minerals that what the price would be 10 years out.
Right.
And Simon predicted the price would be lower in each case. Simon won.
Exactly. Everyone.
Everyone, because Simon's was maintaining what I'm maintaining, and that is that we have never run out of a mineral, we won't run out of oil, and these hoaxes of peak anything are just not understanding how the fundamental economics of energies or minerals or resources work.
Absolutely. It's all corrupted by man.
Exactly. And Simon was brilliant in producing that, and I've studied him for about 20 years, and he's formed a lot of my thinking, quite frankly, and you're very astute to bring that up.
Thank you, Jerry. And I think that you could be the next Julian Simon if you keep it up.
Well, that's quite a compliment. I really thank you very much for that.
What I'd like to do is take your rebuttals now, your final statements, and then we'll go back to take final calls as we run out of time. Michael Rupert, because you started the program, I'll let you go now.
Okay. Thank you. This was a hot debate. We mixed it up pretty good.
If you look, or your listeners, take the time to look at any website or any arguments supporting the abiotic oil theory, you will find that all of them rely on the same three cases to support their claims. The first is the Dnepr-Donets Basin, which is in the Ukraine, where the Russian scientists allege there was an inexhaustible supply of gas and oil, and Mr. Corsi used it. Everybody uses that one. Well, the fact is that the U.S. Geological Survey says there's only 27 billion barrels of oil there. The world uses about 11 billion barrels, a billion barrels every 11 days. And in case nobody noticed in the news lately, Russia just cut off the natural gas flows through the Ukraine because Ukraine is short of natural gas, 30% short, and they're having to go now to Turkmenistan to get gas. So that's an abject failure in terms of what it's produced. Actually, that basin is in decline. Eugene Island off the coast of Louisiana is one of the other main arguments that the abiotic oil guys use. And the fact is that there were some stories that it was refilling. Thomas Gold wrote his book based upon that. But the U.S. Mining and Minerals Service has shown the reserves in strict decline since 1998. Production is now falling off. It did show a rise in production, but there is not a single geologist there, according to an interview done by the Oil and Gas Journal, that believes that there's anything like abiotic oil refilling Eugene Island. And then the last thing that the abiotic oil people use is the Siljan well, which was drilled in Sweden for Thomas Gold in a meteor crater that cost something like $60 million to drill a few years ago. And they only recovered 80 barrels of oil, and that's less than what was put in the drilling sludge to lubricate the drill bit. They found nothing. It's an abject failure. And even counting that well, that oil was costing $750,000 a barrel. So my point is this. Everything that the abiotic oil people use as proof has failed, abjectly failed. It doesn't sustain their theory. And all of these things that they list are old. There's no new data whatsoever. So if they have any cards, it's time to put them on the table. And here's my last short little observation. One of the most profound statements I ever heard was a young lady saying, you know, I'd rather pray to a God and find out that there wasn't than not pray to a God and find out that there was. When we talk about peak oil, this is my position, this is my philosophy, this is what I've dedicated my life to. I beg all the listeners out there to pay attention and to start looking at their own lives and how they would adjust to life in advance if peak oil were true. You got nothing to lose. It may save your life, it may save your family, and it's happening all over this country. There's hundreds of thousands of people now. There's whole communities, regions that are organizing, preparing for peak oil. The town of Willits, California is already almost all the way off the map. And all I want people to do is to listen to these arguments tonight and keep researching until you're satisfied, but just start thinking about protecting and planning ahead for the possibility that it might be true.
Jerry Corsi, go ahead.
First of all, I'd like to say that Michael Rupert and I disagree about abiotic and peak oil. But I want listeners to know, and Michael, for you to know, that I greatly respect your work, your website. I respect the work you've done. I commend you for it, and I'm honored to be in a debate with you on these subjects.
Well, you are a worthy opponent.
Thank you. I'm going to cite a few things. I'm looking at some surveys from the U.S. Geological Survey, one in 1914. It said the United States would soon run out of oil. And there's one in 1926, there's one in 1939, there's one in 1949. I've got a stack of these here that says that the world is running out of oil, the United States is running out of oil. I'm going to refer to a speech that Jimmy Carter gave on April 18th, 1977, in which he projected that we would have used all the proven oil reserves of the world by the end of the 1980s. I'm going to remind the listeners that none of these predictions have ever come true. We still have more oil than we ever have. I'm going to go back to the arguments that I've made. There are specific refutations for the issues that Michael brought up of these specific cases. I'm maintaining that all the oil and natural gas we're finding is abiotic in nature, not just some of it. It's all abiotic. And finally, we're maintaining that there are economics of this. The book Black Gold Stranglehold is the politics of oil. The oil companies made $100 billion a year last year. We have a 7-point solution in that book for solving these problems. And number one is we've got to make sure that the oil companies lose their tax benefits and incentives unless they increase the supply of oil, diesel fuel, and natural gas, and gasoline in the system. We need more refineries. We need more of their reserves to come online. We need to have the people understand that there is abundant oil in the world, and we need it in production. So thank you, George. I also commend your show. It's been a wonderful opportunity to be here again. And thank you for the excellent opportunity to speak with your audience.
Okay, and I'll have the results of the Fast Blast poll in a moment, and we'll wrap things up with some final calls here. First-time caller line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, sir. I'd like to first thank you, George. You keep a lot of us truckers up at night.
Well, thank you. There you are.
Okay, I kind of want to make a point and then a question, if I can.
Sure.
Everybody's been saying on tonight that I'm nervous.
Don't worry about that. You should see what I look like when I drive a truck.
Well, basically, you know, everybody's been making the point that if the American public doesn't have the money to pay for the oil, that these companies go out of business. But if we've seen it with Enron that these CEOs have no problem making as much money as they can before they get out, and that it's going the same way with the oil companies, you know. And my question is that if diesel fuel is a byproduct of gasoline, how come that the oil companies are charging drivers so much more than regular gasoline? I know drivers that are just totally out of business due to diesel gas, and it just keeps going up and up, even though gasoline keeps going lower and lower.
That's a good question. Who wants it in about a minute for it,
Mike?
It's
an excellent question. The reason they're charging more for it is they can get more for it. That's unfortunate. They don't care in the oil companies except for making the money. Unfortunately, this gentleman is right. Greed has no limit. And the oil company executives who testified before Congress did not look to me like any of them had pumped any gas in a long time.
Very quickly, it depends upon what region of the country you're in, but diesel refineries, about, I think, 30% of the nation's refinery capacity is still offline due to Katrina. So you may be seeing an increase because certain diesel-producing refineries are down, the ones supplying your region through various pipelines. There's all kinds of reasons why it might be higher.
All right, the results of the Fast Blast unscientific poll are in. I want to stress that because this is not what we call one of those scientific polls with accuracy of 5%. It could be anything. 62% to 38%. 62% of you believed in Jerry Corsi's theories. 38% believe in Michael Rupert's. I thought it would have been closer. Both of you were very close in terms of the actual live debate.
Well,
Michael, it's an honor to be with you, and maybe the next time it would be just the opposite. So you keep up your arguments, and I look forward to being with you in any form and any time.
Well, I just throw the seeds out. Where they land and how they sprout is not my business.
Both of you coming back for different shows, so thank you, both of you, for being on the program.
George, a great honor. Again, thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Jerry.
Thank you.
62%, 38% of you. 62% of you believe in Jerry Corsi. For Dan Galante, Steve Carr, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasaur, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM.